Side 8, The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Continuing on page 214. In those last years of her marriage, Ruth had performed a sort of adoption of her own. She adopted Haven. The library, for instance. The Methodist parsonage had been full of books since time out of mind. Some were Detective Book Club and Reader's Digest condensed books, from which a clear scent of mold arose when you opened them. Others had bloated to the size of telephone books when the pipes in the parsonage burst in 1947. But most were in surprisingly good condition. Ruth patiently winnowed them, keeping the good ones, selling the bad ones to be repulped, throwing away only those completely beyond salvage. The Haven Community Library had officially opened in the repainted and refurbished Methodist Parsonage in December of 1968, with Ruth McCausland as volunteer librarian, a post she held until 1973. On the day she retired, the trustees hung a photograph of her over the mantel in the reading room. Ruth protested, then gave in when she saw they meant to honor her whether she wanted the honor or not. She could hurt their feelings, she saw, but not alter their purpose. They needed to honor her. The library, which she had begun single-handed, sitting on the cold parsonage floor, bundled up in one of Ralph's old red-checked hunting jackets, her breath smoking from her mouth and nose, sorting patiently through boxes of books until her hands went numb, was, in 1972, voted Maine's small-town library of the year. Ruth would have taken at least some pleasure at this under other circumstances, but she took little pleasure in anything during 1972 and 73. 1972 was the year Ralph McCausland died. In the late spring, he began to complain of bad headaches. In June, a large fire spot appeared in his right eye. X-rays revealed a brain tumor. He died in October, 2 days short of his 37th birthday. In the funeral parlor, Ruth stood looking down into his open coffin for a long time. She had wept almost steadily over the last week, and she suspected that there would be more tears to shed, oceans, perhaps, in the weeks and months ahead. But she would no more have wept in public than she would have appeared there naked. To those watching, which was damn near everyone, she seemed as sweetly composed as always. "Goodbye, dear," she said at last, and kissed the corner of his mouth. She slipped his trooper's ring from the third finger of his right hand and onto the third finger of her own. The next day she drove to G.M. Pollock's in Bangor and had it sized. She wore it until the day she died, and although in the violence of her dying, her arm would be ripped from her shoulder. Neither Bent nor Jingles had any trouble IDing that ring. 2. The library was not Ruth's only service to the town. Each fall she collected for the Cancer Society, and for each of the 7 years she did this, she collected the largest total donation in the Maine Cancer Society small-town category. The secret of her success was simple. Ruth went everywhere. She spoke pleasantly and fearlessly to thick-browed, sunken-eyed back-road dwellers, who often looked almost as mongrelized as the snarling dogs they kept in backyards filled with the dead and decaying bodies of old cars and farm implements. And in most cases, she got a donation. Perhaps some were surprised into it simply because it had been so long since they'd had company. She was dog-bit only once. It was, however, a memorable occasion. The dog itself wasn't big, but it had lots of teeth. "Moran," the mailbox said. No one home but the dog. The dog came around the side of the house, growling, as she stood knocking on the unpainted porch door. She held out a hand to it, and Mr. Moran's dog immediately bit it, and then stepped away from Ruth and piddled on the porch in its excitement. Ruth started down the steps, taking a handkerchief from her purse and wrapping it around her bleeding hand. The dog bounded after her and bit her again, this time on the leg. She kicked at it, and it shied away, but as she limped on toward her dart, it came up behind her and bit her a third time. This was the only serious bite. Mr. Moran's dog removed a sizable chunk of meat from Ruth's left calf. She was wearing a skirt that day. She never went out collecting for the Cancer Society in a skirt again, and then retired to the center of Mr. Moran's weedy front lawn, where it sat snarling and slobbering, Ruth's blood dripping from its lolling tongue. Instead of getting behind the wheel of her car, she opened the Dart's trunk. She did not hurry. She felt if she did, the dog would almost certainly attack her again. She took the Remington .30-06 she'd had ever since she was 16. She shot the dog dead, just as it began trotting toward her again. She picked up the corpse and laid it on spread newspapers in her trunk and drove it to Dr. Daggett, the Augusta vet who had cared for Bobby's dog, Peter, before selling the practice and moving to Florida. "If this bitch was rabid, I am in a good deal of trouble," she told Daggett. The vet peered from the dog, which had a bullet directly between its glazed eyes and very little left to the back of its skull, to Ruth McCausland, who, although bitten and bleeding, was as pleasant as ever. "I know I haven't left as much of the brain for examination as you'd probably like, but that was unavoidable. Would you take a look, Dr. Daggett?" He told her she needed to see a doctor. The wounds had to be flushed, and she'd need stitches in her calf. Daggett was as close to flustered as Daggett ever got. Ruth told him he was perfectly capable of flushing the wounds. As for what she called the crocheting, she would go to the emergency room at Dairy Home as soon as she made a few telephone calls. She told him to work on the dog while she made them, and asked if she could use his private office so as not to upset the clientele. A woman had screamed when Ruth came in, which was not really surprising. One of Ruth's legs was bloody and torn open. In her blood-streaked arm she bore the stiffening, blanket-wrapped corpse of Moran's dog. Daggett said she was welcome to use his phone. She did so, being careful to reverse the charges the first time, and billing the call to her home telephone the second time. She somehow doubted if Mr. Moran would accept a collect call. Ralph was at Monster Dugan's house, going over crime photos for an upcoming manslaughter trial. Monster's wife detected nothing amiss in Ruth's voice, and neither did Ralph. He told her later that she would have made a great criminal. She said she had taken a delay while canvassing for the Cancer Society. She told him if he got home before she did, he should warm up the meatloaf and make himself some of those stir-fried vegetables that he liked. There were 6 or 7 packages in the freezer. Also, she said, there was a coffee cake in the bread box if he fancied something sweet. By now, Daggett had come into the office and was disinfecting her wounds, and Ruth was very pale. Ralph wanted to know what kind of delay she had taken. She said she'd tell him about it when she got home. Ralph said he looked forward to it and said he loved her. Ruth said she felt exactly the same way about him. Then, as Daggett finished with a bite behind her knee, he'd done her hand while she spoke to Ralph, and went on to the deep wound in her calf. She could actually feel her wounded flesh trying to pull away from the alcohol. She called Mr. Moran. Ruth told him his dog had bitten her 3 times, and that was 1 time too many, so she had shot and killed it, and that she had left his pledge card in the mailbox, and the American Cancer Society would be very grateful for any donation he felt he could make. There was a brief silence. Then Mr. Moran began to speak. Soon, Mr. Moran began to shout. Finally, Mr. Moran began to scream. Mr. Moran was so enraged, he attained a vulgar fluency of expression that neared not just poetry, but Homeric verse. He would never equal it again in his life, although when he sometimes tried and failed, he would remember that conversation with a sad, almost fond nostalgia. She'd brought out the best in him, no denying that. Mr. Moran said she could expect to get sued for every town dollar she had, and a few country ones in the bargain. Mr. Moran said he was going to law, and he was poker buddies with the best lawyer in the county. Mr. Moran opined that Ruth was going to find the cartridge she had used to kill his good old dog, the most expensive one she had ever jacked into a breach. Mr. Moran said when he got done with her, she would curse her mother for ever having opened her legs to her father. Mr. Moran said that even though her mother had been stupid enough to do that, he could tell, just talking to her, that the best part of her had squirted out in her father's unquestionably substandard pecker and run down the chunk of lard her mother called a thigh. Mr. Moran informed her that while Mrs. High and Mighty Ruth McCausland might currently feel she was Queen Turd of Shit Hill, she would shortly find out she was just another little turd floating in the great toilet bowl of life. Mr. Moran added that, in this particular case, he had his hand on the lever of that great disposal unit and fully intended to push it. Mr. Moran said a great deal more. Mr. Moran did more than speak. Mr. Moran sermonized. Preacher Colson, or was it Cooter, at the height of his powers, could not have equaled Moran on that day. Ruth waited patiently until he had at least temporarily run dry. Then, speaking in a low and pleasant voice that did not at all suggest that her calf now felt as if it was burning in a furnace, she told Mr. Moran that while the law was not entirely clear on the point, damages had more often been awarded to the caller, even if uninvited, rather than the owner, in cases of animal assault. The real question was whether or not the owner had taken all reasonable care to ensure...
"What the fuck are you talking about?"
Moran screamed. "I'm trying to tell you that the courts take a dim view of a man leaving his dog untied so it can bite a woman soliciting for a charitable organization like the American Cancer Society. Put another way, I'm trying to make you see that in court they make you pay for acting like an asshole." Stunned silence from the other end of the line. Mr. Moran's muse had fled forever. Ruth paused briefly and fought off a wave of faintness as Daggett finished the disinfecting process and put a light sterile bandage on the wound. "If you took me to court, Mr. Moran, could my lawyer find someone to testify that your dog had bitten before?" Silence from the other end of the line. "Perhaps two someones?" More silence. "Perhaps three.
Fuck you, you highbrow cunt,"
Moran said suddenly. "Well," Ruth said, "I can't say it's been pleasant talking with you, but listening to you air your views has certainly been instructive. A person sometimes believes she's seen all the way to the bottom of the well of human stupidity, and a reminder that that well apparently has no bottom is sometimes useful. I'm afraid I'll have to hang up now. I'd hoped to canvass six more houses today, but I'm afraid I'll have to put them off. I have to go up to Dairy Home Hospital and get some stitches, I'm afraid."
"I hope they fucking kill you,"
Moran said. "I understand. But do try to help the Cancer Society if you can. We need all the help we can get if we're going to stop cancer in our lifetime. Even ill-tempered, foul-mouthed, idiotic, misbegotten sons of bitches such as yourself can do their part." Mr. Moran did not sue her. A week later, she received a Cancer Society pledge envelope from him, however. He had not stamped it, on purpose, she suspected, so it would be delivered postage due. Inside was a note and a $1 bill with a large brown stain on it. "I wiped my ass on this, you bitch," the note cried triumphantly. It was written in the large, straggling letters of a first grader with motor control problems. Ruth held the bill by the corner and put it in with the rest of the morning wash. When it came out, clean, among the many other things Mr. Moran did not seem to know was that shit washes off, she ironed it. Then it was not only clean, it was crisp. It might have come from the bank only yesterday. She put it in the canvas bank bag where she kept all her collection money. In her record book, she noted, "D. Moran, amount contributed $1. 3. The Haventown Library. The Cancer Society. The New England Conference of Small Towns. Ruth served Haven in all of them. She was also active in the Methodist Church. It was a rare church supper at which there wasn't a Ruth McCausland casserole, or a bake sale at which there wasn't a Ruth McCausland pie or loaf of raisin bread. She had served on the school board and on the school textbook committee. People said they didn't know how she did it all. When asked directly, she would smile and say she believed busy hands were happy hands. With all of this going on in her life, you would have thought she'd have had no time for hobbies. But she did, in fact, have two. She loved to read. She particularly enjoyed Bobby Anderson's westerns. She had all of them, each signed. And she collected dolls. A psychiatrist would have equated Ruth's doll collection with her unfulfilled wish for children. Ruth, although she did not much hold with psychiatrists, would have agreed. Up to a point, anyway. "Whatever the reason, they make me happy," she might have said if this psychiatric viewpoint had been brought to her attention. "And I believe that happiness is the exact opposite of sadness, bitterness, and hatred. Happiness should remain unexamined as long as possible." In the early Haven years, she and Ralph shared a study upstairs. The house was big enough so each could have had one to him or herself, but they liked to be together in the evenings. The big study had been two rooms before Ralph had knocked out the wall between, creating a space even bigger than the living room downstairs. Ralph had his coin and matchbook collections, a wall of bookshelves. All of Ralph's books were nonfiction, most military history, and an old roll-top desk which Ruth had refinished herself. For Ruth, he made what both came to call the schoolroom. About 2 years before the headaches began, Ralph saw that Ruth was fast running out of space for her dolls. Now there was even a row of them atop her own desk, and they sometimes fell off when she typed. They sat on the stool in the corner, they dangled their small legs nonchalantly from the window ledges, and still visitors usually had to hold three or four on their laps when they took a chair. She had a lot of visitors, too. Ruth was also a notary public, and there was always someone dropping by to have her notarize a bill of sale or Frank a promissory note. So for Christmas that year, Ralph had constructed a dozen small pew-like benches for her dolls. Ruth was delighted. They reminded her of the one-room schoolhouse she had attended at Crossman Corner. She arranged them in neat rows and set the dolls upon them. Ever after, that part of Ruth's study was called the schoolroom. The following Christmas, his last, although at that point he felt fine, the brain tumor that would kill him no more than a microscopic dot in his head, Ralph gave her another four benches, three new dolls, and a blackboard in scale with the benches. It was all that was needed to complete the amiable schoolroom illusion. Written on the blackboard were the words, "Dear teacher, I love you truly. A secret admirer." Adults were charmed by Ruth's schoolroom. Most children were equally charmed, and Ruth was always happy to see the kids, boys as well as girls, play with the dolls, although some were quite valuable and many of the old ones delicate. Some parents became very nervous when they realized their children were playing with a doll from pre-communist China or one that had belonged to the daughter of Chief Justice John Marshall. Ruth was a kind woman. If she sensed that a child's enjoyment of her dolls was making a parent really uncomfortable, she would take out a Barbie and Ken she kept for such occasions. The children played with them, but listlessly, as if they realized the really good dolls had for some reason been put off limits. If, however, Ruth sensed that parents were saying no because they felt it was somehow impolite for their kids to play with a grown-up lady's toys, she would make it clear that she really didn't mind. "Ain't you afraid some kid'll break a bunch of them?" Mabel Noyes asked her once. Mabel's junkatorium was well supplied with signs such as, "Lovely to look at, delightful to hold, but if you break it, then it's sold." Mabel knew that the doll which had belonged to Justice Marshall's little girl was worth at least $600. She had shown a picture of it to a dealer in rare dolls in Boston, and he had told her $400, so Mabel guessed $600 as a fair price. Then there was a doll that had belonged to Anna Roosevelt, a genuine Haitian voodoo doll, God knew what else, sitting cheek to cheek and thigh to thigh with such common old things as Raggedy Ann and Andy. "Not a bit," Ruth responded. She found Mabel's attitude as puzzling as Mabel found hers. "If God means one of these dolls to be broken, he may break it himself, or he may send a child to do it. But so far no child has ever broken one." "Oh, a few heads have rolled, and Joe Pell did something to the pole ring and Mrs. Beasley's back, and now all she'll say is something like, 'Do you want to have a shower?' But that's about all the damage that's been done." "Well, you'll pardon me if I still think it's an awfully big risk to take with such fragile, irreplaceable things," Mabel said. She sniffed. "Sometimes I believe the only thing I've ever learned in my whole life is that children break things." "Well, perhaps I've just been lucky. But they are careful with them, you know. Because they love them, I think." Ruth paused, frowning slightly. "Most of them do," she amended after a moment. "That not all children wanted to play with the kids in the schoolroom, that some actually seemed to fear them, was a fact which puzzled and grieved her. Little Edwina Thurlow, for instance. Edwina had burst into a shrill spate of screams when her mother took her by the hand and actually pulled her over to the dolls on their rows of benches, looking attentively at their blackboard. Mrs. Thurlow thought Ruth's dolls were just the dearest things, cunning as a cat a-running, sweet as a lick of cream. If there are other country clichés for fascinating, Mrs. Thurlow had undoubtedly applied them to Ruth's dolls, and she was totally unable to credit her daughter's fear of them. She thought Edwina was just being shy. Ruth, who had seen the flat, unmistakable glitter of fear in the child's eyes, had been unable to dissuade the mother, who Ruth thought was a stupid, pig-headed woman, from almost physically pushing the child at the dolls. So Norma Thurlow had dragged little Edwina over to the schoolroom, and little Edwina's screams had been so loud they had brought Ralph all the way up from the cellar, where he had been caning chairs. It took 20 minutes to coax Edwina out of her hysterics, and of course she had to be brought downstairs away from the dolls. Norma Thurlow was ill with embarrassment, and every time she threw a black look Edwina's way, her daughter was overcome again by hysterical weeping. Later that evening, Ruth went upstairs and looked sorrowfully at her schoolroom full of silent children. The children included such grandmotherly figures as Mrs. Beasley and old Gammer Hood, which, when turned over and slightly rearranged, became the Big Bad Wolf. Wondering how they could have scared Edwina so badly. Edwina herself certainly hadn't been able to explain. Even the most gentle inquiry brought on fresh shrieks of terror.
"You made that kid really unhappy," Ruth said at last, speaking softly to the dolls. "What did you do to her?"
The dolls only looked back at her with their glass eyes, their shoe-button eyes, their sewn eyes. And Hilly Brown wouldn't go near them the time his mother came over to have you notarize that bill of sale,
Ralph said from behind her.
She looked around, startled, then smiled at him.
"Yes, Hilly too," she said.
And there had been others. Not many, but enough to trouble her.
"Come on," Ralph said, slipping an arm around her waist. "Give, you guys. Which one of you's mugs scared the little Goyle?"
The dolls looked back silently. And for a moment, just a moment, Ruth felt a stir of fright uncoil in her stomach and chase up her spine, rattling vertebrae like a bony xylophone. And then it was gone.
"Don't worry about it, Ruthie,"
Ralph said, leaning closer. As always, the smell of him made her feel a bit giddy. He kissed her hard, nor was his kiss the only thing hard about him at that moment.
"Please," she said a little breathlessly, breaking the kiss. "Not in front of the children."
He laughed and swept her into his arms.
"How about in front of the collected works of Henry Steele Commager?"
"Wonderful," she gasped, aware that she was already half, no, three-quarters, no, four-fifths,
out of her dress. He made love to her urgently and with tremendous satisfaction on both their parts. All their parts. The brief chill was forgotten. But this year she remembered on the night of July 19th. The picture of Jesus had begun to speak to Becca Paulson on July 7th. On July 19th, Ruth McCausland's dolls began to speak to her. 4. The townsfolk were surprised but pleased when, 2 years after Ralph McCausland's death in 1972, his widow ran for the position of Haven Town Constable. A young fellow named Mumphrey ran against her. This fellow was foolish, most people agreed, but they also agreed that he probably couldn't help it. He was new in town and did not know how to behave. Those who discussed the matter at the Haven lunch agreed Mumphrey was more to be pitied than disliked. He ran as a partisan Democrat, and the gist of his platform seemed to be that when it came to a position such as constable, the elected official would have to arrest drunks, speeders, and hooligans. He might even be called upon to arrest a dangerous criminal from time to time and run him up to the county jail. Surely the citizens of Haven weren't going to elect a woman to do such a job, law degree or not, were they? They were, and did. The vote was McCausland 407, Mumphrey 9. Of his 9 votes, it would be fair to assume he had gotten those of his wife, his brother, his 23-year-old son, and himself. That left 5 unaccounted for. No one ever fessed up, but Ruth herself always had an idea that Mr. Moran out there on the south end of town had had 4 more friends than she would have credited him with. 3 weeks after the election, Mumphrey and his wife left Haven. His son, a nice enough fellow named John, elected to stay, and although he was still, after 14 years, often referred to as the new fella, as in, "That new fella, Mumphrey, came by to get his hair cut this morning. Remember when his daddy ran against Ruth and got whipped so bad?" And since then Ruth had never been opposed. The townsfolk had rightly seen her candidacy as a public announcement that her period of mourning was over. One of the things, one among many, the unfortunate Mumphrey had failed to understand, was that the lopsided vote had been, in part at least, Haven's way of crying, "Hooray, Ruthie! Welcome back!" Ralph's death had been sudden and shocking,
and it came close, too very damn close, to killing the part of her which was outward and giving. That part softened and complemented the dominant side of her personality, she felt. The dominant side was smart, canny, logical, and, although she hated to admit this last, she knew it was true. Sometimes, uncharitable. She came to feel that if that outward and giving side of her nature were to lapse, it would be something like killing Ralph a second time. And so she came back to Haven, came back to service. In a small town, even one such person can make a crucial difference in how things are and in what Jargonmeisters are pleased to call the quality of life. That person can become, in fact, something very like the heart of the town. Ruth had been well on her way to becoming such a valuable person when her husband died. 2 years later, after what seemed in retrospect to be a long, bleak season in hell, she had rediscovered that valuable person, as one might rediscover something moderately wonderful in a dark attic corner, a piece of carnival glass, or a bent wood rocking chair that was still serviceable. She held it up to the light, made sure it was unbroken, dusted it, polished it, and then returned it to her life. Running for town constable had only been the first step. She could not have said why this seemed so right, but it did. It seemed the perfect way to, at the same time, remember Ralph and get on with the work of being herself. She thought she would probably find the job both boring and unpleasant, but that had also been true of canvassing for the Cancer Society and serving on the textbook selection committee. Boring and unpleasant did not mean a task was unfruitful, a fact a lot of people seemed not to know or to willfully ignore. And, she told herself, if she really didn't like it, there was no law to make her stand for re-election. She wanted to serve, not to martyr herself. If she hated it, she would let Mumphrey or someone like him have a turn. But Ruth discovered she liked the job. Among other things, it gave her a chance to put a stop to some nasty goings-on that old John Harley had allowed to continue and grow. Del Cullum, for instance. The Cullums had been in Haven since time out of mind, and Delbert, a thick-browed mechanic who worked at Elk Barker's Shell, was probably not the first of them to engage in sexual congress with his daughters. The Cullum line was incredibly twisted and interbred. There were at least two cataclysmically retarded Cullums in Pineland that Ruth knew of. According to town gossip, one had been born with webs between its fingers and toes. Incest is one of those time-honored country traditions of which the romantic poets rarely write. Its traditional aspect might have been the reason John Harley had never seriously tried to put an end to it, but the idea of tradition in such a grotesque matter cut no ice with Ruth. She went out to the Cullum place. There was shouting. Albion Thurlow heard it clearly, although Albion lived a quarter of a mile down the road and was deaf in one ear. Following the shouting, there was the sound of a chainsaw cranking up, followed by a gunshot and a scream. Then the chainsaw stopped, and Albion, standing out in the middle of the road now, one hand shading his eyes as he looked toward the Cullum place, heard girls' voices. Delbert had been cursed with girls, six of them, and of course they literally were his curse and he theirs, raised in cries of distress. Later, in the Haven lunch, recounting his tale to a fascinated audience, old Albion said that he thought about going back into his house and calling the constable, and then he realized the constable had probably been the one fired the shot. Albion only stood by his mailbox instead, awaiting developments. About 5 minutes after the sound of the chainsaw died, Ruth McCausland drove back toward town. 5 minutes after that, Del Cullum drove by in his pickup. His washed-out wife was in the shotgun seat. A mattress and some cardboard boxes filled with clothes and dishes sat in the truck's bed. Delbert and Maggie Cullum were seen no more in Haven. The three Cullum girls over 18 went to work in Derry and in Bangor. The three minors were placed in foster homes. Most of Haven was glad to see the Cullum family broken up. They had festered out there at the end of the ridge road like a rash of poisoned toadstools growing in a dark cellar. Folks speculated about what Ruth had done and how she did it, but Ruth never told. Nor were the Cullums the only people Ruth McCausland, graying, trim, 5'5" and 125 pounds, either ran out of town or had jailed over the years. There were the dope-smoking hippies that moved in a mile east of the old Frank Garrick farm, for instance. Those worthless, crab-rattle excuses for human beings came in one month and went out on the toe of Ruth's dainty size 5 shoe the next. Frank's niece, who wrote those books, probably smoked some rope from time to time, the town thought that all writers must smoke dope, drink to excess, or spend their evenings having sex in odd positions, but she didn't sell it, and the hippies half a mile down from her had been doing just that. Then there were the Jorgensons, out on the Miller Bog Road. Benny Jorgensen died of a stroke, and Iva remarried 3 years later, becoming Iva Haney. Not long after, her 7-year-old son and 5-year-old daughter started having household mishaps. The boy fell, getting out of the tub. The girl burned her arm on the stove. Then the boy slipped on the wet kitchen floor and broke his arm, and the girl stepped on a rake half buried in fallen leaves, and the handle spanged her upside the head. Last, but hardly least, the boy stumbled on the basement stairs while going after some kindling and fractured his skull. For a while, it looked as if he wasn't going to pull through. It was a real run of bad luck, all right. Ruth decided there had been enough bad luck at the Haney place. She went out, driving her old Dodge Dart, and found Elmer Haney sitting on the porch drinking a quart of Miller Lite, picking his nose and reading Soldier of Fortune magazine. Ruth suggested to Elmer Haney that he was bad luck around Iva's place, particularly for Bethy and Richard Jorgensen. She had noticed, she said, that some stepfathers were very bad luck for their stepchildren. She said she thought their luck might improve if Elmer Haney left town. Very soon. Before the end of the week. "You are not scaring me," Elmer Haney said serenely. "This is my place now. You want to get off it before I brain you with a stick of stove wood, you meddling bitch."
"Think it over," Ruth said, smiling. Joe Paulson had been parked out by the mailbox at the time. He heard the whole thing. Elmer Haney's voice had been slightly raised, and there was nothing wrong with Joe's hearing. The way Joel told it down at the Haven lunch later that day, he had been sorting mail while the two of them argued it up and down, and he couldn't seem to get it sorted just right until that conversation was over.
"Then how'd you know she was smiling?"
Elt Barker asked.
"Heard it in her voice," Joe replied.
Later that same day, Ruth had taken a ride up to the Derry State Police Barracks and spoke with Butch, Monster, Dugan. At 6'8" and 280 pounds, Monster was the largest state cop in New England. Monster would have done anything short of murder. Maybe that, too, for Ralph's widow. 2 days later, they went back to the Haney place. It was Monster's day off, and he was in civvies. Iva Haney was at work. Bethy was in school. Richard was, of course, still in the hospital. Elmer Haney, who was still unemployed, sat on the porch with a quart of Miller Lite in one hand and the latest issue of Hot Talk in the other. Ruth and Monster Dugan visited with him for an hour or so. During that hour, Elmer Haney had an extraordinary run of bad luck. Those who saw him leaving town that night said he looked like someone ran him through a potato grater. But the only one with nerve enough to ask just what had happened was old John Harley himself.
"Well, I swan," Ruth said, smiling. "It was the darndest thing I ever saw. While we were trying to persuade him his stepkids might live luckier if he left, he decided he wanted to take a shower, right while we were talking to him. And do you know he fell down in the tub? Then he burned his arm on the stove and slipped on the linoleum while he was backing away from it. Then he decided he wanted some fresh air, and he went outside and stepped on the same rake little Bethy Jorgensen stepped on 2 months ago, and that was when he decided he ought to just pack up and go. I think he was right to do it, poor man. He'll live luckier himself somewhere else."